Welcome. Today is May 9th, and we are back with the Education Conference Committee. Today we are going to look at some provisions that were unique to the Senate. We wanted to have just a bit of time to talk about these provisions, why they're important to the Senate, and just to note, we do have to take a hard stop at 4:45. The Senate is in the Senate. Republicans are in caucus at 5, something we have to attend. So we will have a bit of a shorter meeting today. But we'll start off today with Tony Sanna and the Sanna Foundation. This is a provision, and today we're looking at finance provisions that are unique to the Senate bill. And we'll start with the Sanna Foundation. We have Tony Sanna, who will be speaking about what the Sanna Foundation does and how it impacts kids. Welcome, Tony. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Sanna, we have a maximum of 10 minutes for each of our speakers.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to keep this short. Yes. My name is Tony Sanna. I'm the CEO of the Sanna Foundation. I want to also thank Representative Hewitt and Senator Anderson for authoring our bills. Our program is an in-school academic intervention and support program. Years ago, when I retired, I thought about why I made it as an African American kid that grew up in the Twin Cities. On the east side of St. Paul, I was the only African American kid in my grade school. I realized it wasn't sports, it was the relationships. So I went back to college to study how I was going to build an organization based on relationships. And that's what I did. Our program puts mentors in schools that we call coaches. Our model is we put 3 full-time staff, 75% of our staff come from communities of colors, inside of schools to develop relationships with students. We try to connect with however we can. We do a lot of training around cultural competencies. We partner with the Search Institute, the Harvard HSA model, as well as multiple school districts. In schools that we go into, we've seen an average of a 50% decrease in referrals and suspensions because we've been able to build better relationships for the students in the schools. We've also seen increased performance in academic data and attendance as well. I've tried to make a program that is fiscally efficient, and so we think we've been great stewards of your support with us. 3 years ago when we started, we were only in St. Paul and St. Paul School District, and we were able to expand to Minneapolis, Rochester, and St. Cloud, and we have some great performing schools to date. We've also invested in making the program better. We have a dual program that was so successful that the schools were hiring our staff right before our eyes to work in the schools. Our argument was if they work with us, they work with you, but not the other way around. So I went back to the drawing board to try to get more intentional about it. We started working with the St. Paul Federation of Teachers to do training for our staff to connect our students with the teachers. And it just happened that the professional development that they gave was provided by the University of St. Mary's. I then went to the University of St. Mary's and asked, if I'm already taking master's courses, what does it take to become a teacher? Because I have highly motivated people that are working in schools. A lot of them are youth studies majors that want to work with direct service their whole life. But they didn't realize that teaching was probably the highest paying direct service job that you can get, working one-on-one with students your whole life. So I sat down with them, and it took us 2 years. And thanks to your investment, they believed that there was possibilities. And we now are running a pathway program across 3 different school districts, which is kind of unique. So when we look at your priorities, the Senate and the House and the statewide priorities to increase teachers of color, this is a model that's being run across 3 different school districts with the same cohort. We are also decreasing our behavioral incidents a lot. So currently, our staff work in the public schools and the charter school, and they act as mentors And during the summer, they go to school full-time. And their training days are master's courses that are integrated into their training plan. And so they receive all 60 credits, and they get paid in the summertime and while they're student teaching. So we believe that we are not lowering any standards, but lowering barriers. At the same time, we're supporting the public schools that we're working in. So I think there might be some misconceptions on maybe my marketing team is doing too good of a job that, you know, things are easy, but they're not. And we work very hard to make ourselves look good and to inspire the people that we work with, not only the students, but our young coaches. And, you know, we are asking people to invest in a lifelong career in teaching, which has not been highlighted or respected up to this date. I recently, you know, got a Bush Fellowship that I'm proud of, and I'm focusing on two issues. One is, you know, holding sports teams more accountable for philanthropy, because I should be the norm, not the exception. And I want to work with more athletes and teams so that giving means truly giving. And the second part is to develop pathway programs for people of color, because I've seen the data and I've seen the effect that my staff have on kids in the Twin Cities and now across the state. So I just want to thank you for your consideration. And for those of you who hadn't heard about the program, I hope there was something in here that caught your eye. But we've been a fiscally responsible organization that's used your support in the past to leverage resources to do more. And we are not the same program that we were 3 years ago. We're better. It's because of you. And we would like to continue to grow with you in the future so that every child gets opportunities that they serve, and we have to start with the teachers, the support systems, and the youth themselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sani. And we may have questions, but we'll talk about those at another time. We're going to try and get through our testifiers today. So thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda, we have 10 minutes from Zeke Jackson, People for PSEO. And that's talking about those enrollment options in transportation. I believe that is a Senate-only provision. And so welcome, Zeke, if you can introduce yourself for the record, please. And if you have anyone else with you today, they should come up at the same time.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Rep. Dabney, Chair Dabney.
However that works.
Yeah.
You're not allowing questions of the testifiers today?
Mr. Chair.
It seems like the clarification, that sort of thing might be helpful.
We can do that. I was just a little cognizant of the time. And so I know I had a couple things I would have liked Mr. Sane to say. And so, you know, I think if we could collect those questions or clarifications, if the members wouldn't mind giving us telling us the information that you want, we'll try and collect that information. I'm just cognizant of the time, or, of course, we'd be welcome to bring folks back. So are you sensing that there are folks who want to ask more in-depth questions than what might be available for a question and then receiving an answer?
I think there's two sides to the coin. One is the I assume you invited these people because of their knowledge and expertise, and as soon as they walk out the door, that knowledge and expertise is now gone.
Except we know how to get hold of them.
True, but for us to deliberate, I would like us all to have access to the same information.
At
so
the same time.
Asking the questions when the testifiers are here grants everyone the access to the information.
Oh, I think I think that's a fine thing to do. We'll just try and keep our comments short, our deliberations short, knowing that we won't answer everything today. And so, Zeke, you might get a few questions, and that's fine. But knowing that we can always come back to, we can always get whatever information we aren't able to get
today.
What
about Mr. Sani?
Oh, Mr. Sani.
I don't mean to blow up Zeke.
Yeah. But come on back up. I know I'll mention the two things I was hoping you would address just very briefly. And Zeke, you're welcome to stay there. No problem. What I was curious about was, just about your budget, your total budget, you know, what percent is like state funding, and I think you do some private funds as well. You can just kind of speak to that. That was just one quick question that I had. Mr. Stanny.
Our total budget is a little over $3.5 million this year, and this year we've had used, I think, $450,000 in state funds.
Thank you. And then just the last item of information. For the record, you're awfully young to have retired. Tell us about what you retired from.
Well, in my former career, I was a professional soccer player.
Thank you. And
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Chair Gavin.
Mr. Senate, thank you for being here today. You indicated some positive changes in both academics and behaviors in the schools that you are in. Can you identify for us what research organization who did the research that tied those changes to your presence in the school, your organization's presence?
So the way that it works is we collect the data for the input, so we record everything that we do and the school and with the students that we work with, and the school district gives us the results. So like in St. Cloud, for instance, we say, here's who we're working with, here's what we did, what's the change in that? So the research, I guess, is the data that we get, we can't create. The data that we get around academic, which in one Minneapolis public schools, they came back and said our literacy scores were higher than the in-school literacy tutors. So we get our data from the school district. We don't create the data. We only create data on what we perform. So we collect data on what we do, which is how many hours we spend, what we do. Like one data point I know is if we spend at least 8 hours a year doing social-emotional services, we get better academic data. We give our inputs with the district. The district gives us the outcomes on the performance of the students and the attendance.
Quick follow-up.
Mr.
Stanny, there's been no independent validation of the data.
Mr. Stanny.
Well, the school district themselves, when they give it to you, they give you the data. So unless the school district has given us faulty data and faulty grades, I have no way to prove that. But you're right. We have not had a third party come in and look at the school data if, in fact, every grade that they give us. But it usually takes 6 months. So they give us the data at the end of the school year, and they say it's provisional. So we're not allowed to publish it until they actually. So, but I'm assuming that the school has a third party evaluator or independent agency that goes through theirs before they certify it and give it back to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
For the questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sane, for being here today. And we spoke in my office, but I hadn't heard you mention the pathway program for teaching, and I just want to make sure I understand it's not you haven't applied for one of the alternative pathway grants that we have. Is this more of a grow-your-own program that you're working with the districts?
Mr. Sane.
We partner with St. Mary's University, and so we help administrate it with them, where our students, while they're working, go to school running the same program. So they're actually getting 2 years of in-school experience and doing their student teaching in the schools that they're working with. So it's a collaboration with the three school districts and the University of St. Mary's.
Madam Chair?
Thank you. Chair Yuki.
So just so I understand, it sounds wonderful. So they're getting it's a traditional licensure program.
They're getting a traditional licensure approved, all of 60 credits. And so it's not an alternative. I believe the term someone said it could be considered unconventional since they are in school more time than the traditional teacher would be.
Thank you so much, Mr. Stanny.
Thank you for the question. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're going to jump ahead a little bit. I see we have our McPhail folks are here and ready to go. So come on down. One of the pieces that's in our Senate bill is a grant to the McPhail music education that allows them to take their education throughout the state. We'll talk a little bit more about what that music education looks like, but perhaps they can give us just a little example, and you can imagine yourself being right here with them or across somewhere else in the state. Thank you. It off, but I know other members may have a few questions too, but I just thank you for bringing that to us today. And I know you reach kids all across our state through online resources, those screens. We can see that directing. I've seen that where the director is in one spot and the band or the orchestra or the chorale is in another spot. And we live in a very exciting time when our internet access is fast enough that we can actually do that almost in real time. We know that some of our medical procedures are able to almost be performed in real time via online. And so what I'd like you to do, if you could just take a couple minutes and talk about how, you know, getting a world-class musicians such as yourself out into all corners of the state. How does that happen? And maybe just tell us a little bit about what you do and some of the successes you've seen with the students. And introduce yourself, Mr. Carpenter. Welcome.
My name is Kyle Carpenter. I'm the CEO of the McPhail Center for Music. And we are one of the oldest and the largest community music center in the United States, 16,000 students. We're known as an innovator, and one of the programs is this one we're talking about. We're the only institution in the country that is delivering live online music lessons to rural communities where they've had cutbacks in arts programs. And in the state of Minnesota, that's been true for us. And we've now been able to reach some 33 different districts and over 1,000 kids a week with the program. It's all at the direction of the local band leader, orchestra leader. We ask, where would you need help? We turn to McPhail's 240 faculty members and find the right person that can connect on that weekly basis. We get to know those kids, they get to know us, and the teacher gets an opportunity to learn a bit about how to teach jazz or how to do some of the unique things that McPhail can deliver. And rather than my taking any more time, I would just suggest these are all teachers who teach online to schools in rural Minnesota from our location in downtown Minneapolis. We use fairly ubiquitous technology, but we're pleased that we haven't found a place yet with the good graces of the state of Minnesota that broadband is covering our needs for the most part for this program, and we're using it well. I think it's a playing field leveler, if you will. This is providing world-class music education to those places. And you wanted to start down the list here.
And introduce yourself, please, and then tell us.
Hi, I'm Julie Johnson, and I'm on the flute faculty at McPhail. I teach flute and improvisation and a little bit of composition as well. And that's to the online kids as well as to in-person. I just have to say about the online program, I feel particularly invested in the program.
I need to ask you all to get to the mic, I guess, behind the table. Well, we're not hearing you. You're not being picked up. So please get in front of the mic. Thank you so much. And just reintroduce yourself one more time.
Hello, is this on? Yes.
You're on.
Hi, my name is Julie Johnson, and I'm on the flute faculty at MacPhail. I was just saying how invested I am in particular in this online program at MacPhail. I grew up in Lake of the Woods County, way up on the northernmost part of Minnesota, and I learned flute in the band program, but very quickly realized I needed some further instruction. But there wasn't anybody around. There wasn't anybody to get lessons from. And so I wasn't able to have private flute lessons until I was in high school and got an artist mentor scholarship through some of the state funding. And but I had to drive 2 hours one way in order to get the private lessons. I would have loved a program such as this at MacPhail to be able to connect weekly with a professional musician who was an expert on my instrument. It would have been so formative and life-changing, and I feel so excited that I get to be that person now for these kids that are in the situation that I was in. So thank you so much for having us today.
Thank you.
My name is Mike Alexander. I'm the French horn faculty at MacPhail. I'm the principal horn of the Minnesota Opera Orchestra as well. I just think, like Julie, I grew up in northern Minnesota and just didn't have access to the same level of arts education that you'll find here in the metro area. I was very fortunate to have a really great horn teacher. I got a lot of opportunities. There just happened to be one really great French horn teacher in my community. But I look at clarinets and flutes and oboes that were there, and they didn't have any of those same opportunities. And so I was able to kind of get access to that great education, and then I'm really thrilled to be able to provide that same level of service. Like Julie, it's really great to feel like I get that opportunity to be that for kids across the state and to provide really incredible resources for a bunch of kids. I think one thing that I think is really evident to the success of the program, about Kyle mentioned it as a great leveler or an equalizer amongst our populations here, is that, you know, I look at the levels of when I was growing up of all state musicians, and the northern Minnesota, the outstate areas, just didn't have the same level of participation in those programs. But now I have, of my online school partnerships students, you know, even these outstate musicians, I have several all-state musicians right now. So I have three that I just found out were selected. You know, so that's really exciting to see that just in our outstate students. So, yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon, Greg Keel. I'm MacPhail Saxophone, the Community Partnership and Jazz Combo faculty. And I'm very pleased to just share a new piece of knowledge that two of my students from Wilmer were selected, that I've seen for the last couple of years online through our community online school partnership, were selected for Minnesota Allstate. As was just stated, the ability for the playing field to be leveled is marvelous for students who can't come all the way to downtown Minneapolis or our other locations around the metro area. Plus, since music education is also just a great leveler for life's learning lessons, the fact that these students, that we can connect on an artistic level and on a personal level online, is dramatic. It's life-changing for all of us. And we're bringing all of our resources, and that's resources from concert and classical to jazz and pop. The artists we've had the wonderful opportunity to work with, we share that with our online students, and the level of success is just extraordinary. The chance to bring this throughout the state is a wonderful opportunity and a wonderful responsibility that we really enjoy. So thank you.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Babcock, and I'm a percussion instructor in addition to being an administrator at MacPhail. I normally don't play on a box. I usually play on drums and classical percussion. And I, too, grew up in a rural area where I had to travel a long distance to receive lessons. And so it's a real pleasure to have this program that's making such a difference. And it makes such a difference for the students who want to excel and move on to college, and we have a number of students moving on to being majors in music. It also really helps the students who are struggling to be successful, not only in school but within their band program. And you start to move along that student who is having some challenges and maybe looking at not participating in a program such as a band, choir, or orchestra program, and this helps them succeed in that. Once they succeed in that, then they can succeed in so many other things in school and in life. And so it's just a great program all the way around that's making a difference. And one of the most important things, I think, is that it's completely at the direction of what the music educator has for their needs, where they're so in touch with the needs of their school and their program, we can plug in and help accomplish those needs to make their program and their school stronger. Thank you for hearing us today.
Oh, thank you so much. Kyle, Mr. Carpenter, do you have any further comments?
You're not going to hear from the bass player?
Oh, you are kind of slinking in the back there.
Yeah. I think that's the personality of bass player.
Uh-huh, exactly. Hide behind that guitar.
It's all about that bass.
Exactly. So, welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me. So, unlike my colleagues, I'm actually not a teacher at McPhail. I'm a staff member at McPhail. I work in our student services office. So I don't have direct support to our online school partnership program, but I actually do a lot of work with online individual lessons. So I've had the chance to see other students in similar situations who maybe are not at our partner schools or partner schools yet, students who do live in outstate Minnesota who are connecting with us for individual lessons on cello or on violin, on piano. And it's definitely been, for me, a great joy to be able to see those students, their families, get connected with the education that they're looking for music. So thanks for having me, and thanks for bringing me out from behind the bass.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Mr. Carpenter.
Just a final comment is that this particular bill and the funding associated with it really would help us to work on a waiting list of schools who have come forward, largely through word of mouth, through superintendents, through the band directors, through Minnesota Music Educators Association, to want to participate in this program. And we would be very excited to be able to expand the reach of this program. And it's just been a great proven success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if any questions from the House members? Yes, Rep. Sandstein.
Madam Chair, can you name that tune?
Oh, I can. Can you?
Yes, ma'am, I can.
Eye of the Tiger.
Very good, very good. Without dating myself, it was a popular hit in pep band days long ago. So excellent job.
So thank you so very much. I know there could be so many more questions, but I know we've got some limited time. But again, thank you, and thank you for what you do. It's so exciting to hear about those students who are getting these professional lessons now via online, because every band instructor is terrific, but they're not all experts in every single instrument. And so, it just like in teaching, it takes that, in the classroom, it takes that one person that can connect with that student and take them to the next level. So thank
Madam
you so
Madam
much.
Chair, can I just a
yes,
quick,
sure,
thank you. I just want to ask just a little bit about the current funding. So understood this new funding, and I think it's $200,000 per year, would allow to expand to some of the waitlisted schools. What's the source of funding for the current schools?
The source of funding for the current schools is really made up of some school funding. They fund it themselves. They have some skin in the game. It's usually about maybe 15% or 20% of the cost. Sure. We also have had the National Endowment for the Arts funding as we got that going, some state arts board funding along the way, but largely foundation grants, Bremer, Blandin, and a few others. And that's helped us get the momentum going on this, but we need some more help in order to actually address the real next opportunity.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. And next, we have at 4 o'clock, I think we have Doug Baker with CEO Ecolab, excuse me. So Mr. Baker is spoke at, you might recall, Mr. Baker, we were at the One Minnesota Conference earlier this year, and we heard you speak eloquently about education. I'll just kind of set the stage a little bit. The setting of the conference was at the Hubert Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. And, you know, we cannot miss that association with the school's former dean, John Brandel. And John Brandel was a Minnesota economist, state legislator, dean of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and he also served as deputy assistant secretary in the Department of Health and Education and Welfare during the Johnson administration. And I just will touch on, as we listen to Mr. Baker, the report that that John Brandel and Congressman Weber prepared called An Agenda for Reform. And it lines right up with what we're going to hear today from Ecolab's CEO, Doug Baker. So welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Great, thank you. Doug Baker, so Chairman Nelson, thank you. I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity. So I am Doug Baker. I do run Ecolab. We are a neighbor of yours, at least when you're in session. We're a half a mile down the hill, so not very far away. However, we run a global company. We have 50,000 associates around the world. We serve 3 million businesses in 172 countries. And what we provide is food safety, water recycle reuse programs, and hygiene programs. And we're the leader in all those areas in the fields that we focus on. We are blessed to be part of Minnesota. We are proud neighbors, and we work to do our part as well. So while we aim to succeed financially, succeed for our customers, succeed for our team, we also work to do the right thing by communities. One of the areas that I personally take an interest in over the last years is early learning. And starting in 2003, I, with a number of other civic leaders and business leaders, was part of a group that formed Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, or MELF. And the MELF program was really designed to understand, could we take ideas that were coming out of the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis and other areas and develop proven programs that could help children, particularly those who need it most, low-income kids, who we know over half of which weren't ready for kindergarten. And so we raised $20 million privately. And what we ended up doing was testing a program of empowering the parents, believing that parents want the best for their children, but what they need is the means to do it and the information to do it. And the other component of the program was parent aware, i.e. allowing people to understand which programs were high quality, which programs were focused not just, I would say, on child care, but also on child education along proven curriculums. What we learned was much of what earlier studies had indicated, and that is when you invest in low-income kids and you put them in high-quality education situations, you end up having a great impact in terms of preparation. Long studies have also shown that they end up performing much better in life, even if they don't perform better every year in education, but they end up performing much better over their lifetime in terms of propensity to end up in the criminal justice system or other measures. And so we believe it's a very smart way to positively impact and give people a chance very early. Big piece of the funding was spent on evaluating the programs that we put in place. The evaluations proved to be quite effective. All this is public record, readily available, et cetera. MELF sunsetted, closed gaps by five organizations in a way took its place and has continued to steward Parent Aware program as well as do advocacy work going forward. And I served on that board post MELF all the way up until January of this year where I was co-chair as well. So this has been 16, 17 years of work. It's been fascinating. I've learned a lot. And I really strongly believe this is one of the smartest areas of investment that we can make to help people take advantage of systems. We understand clearly that if you don't have the educational advantages, you are in for a very different outlook in life long term. So we have seen these models work. As we go forward, the state has made really great progress in this area by providing scholarships to eligible families with kids aged 3 to 4 and high risk from birth to 2. And we really believe we need to continue to fulfill the mandate that we started along this path and make this a priority. If achievement gaps is a big issue, which it is for our state, one of the largest, then helping close the gap and prioritizing efforts to close that gap, we think ought to be priority one. And we really believe that funding and fully funding these scholarships, getting on a path to do that, is very important. So continuing this path, building these scholarship funds up over time, is vital, we believe. So number one, we like funding pathway one, early learning scholarships. These scholarships are more flexible and portable for parents. Parents often have to move. It's important that they have the ability to continue to find their kids the right programs near work, near where they live, etc. We also want to continue making progress in funding families currently eligible for scholarships. We should meet our obligations to these families before expanding eligibility and support efforts to enhance the system. There are a number of things that I've seen that I strongly support. There are a lot of efforts that the state's early learning investments are being designed to work even better for families, children, and early care. Things like the house language requiring a report on improved coordination of early learning programs, the Senate language moving forward to the state's existing kindergarten early assessment, and three, the efforts to create a special reserve fund for scholarships to ensure every dollar allocated for scholarships gets to the families who need them. So fundamentally, we believe this is a very important priority. We would like to see the promise fulfilled, and we are advocating for exactly that. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Baker. And we heard you talk about the provisions both in the House, the Senate, and the governor's bill. So hopefully we can get those good provisions throughout. And just to kind of add a little bit more to that, that report that in 1995, that agenda for reform, kind of speaks to and looks ahead to what we are seeing today. Basically, just called for an overall structure for change in state government, plus specific approaches in each of the major government spending areas. And basically, their central conclusion was that in the future, which is today, where we are now, government in Minnesota cannot meet its responsibilities without some sweeping reforms. And those needed reforms are based on achieving results through competition, encouraging communities, and concentrating spending on people most in need. And that's really what we see in this, in our scholarship model. And competition in the private sector does lead to those improved services, improved costs. And this is a direct quote out of the report, but that government responsibilities are usually carried out by monopoly government bureaus. In addition, where communities have been providing services, the results have usually been superior to government programs and the costs much lower. And that was one of the quotes in their report. And the report also called for instituting reforms to offer consumers of government services choices, which we see today in the scholarship model, and to carry out more of its work through families, which we also see in empowering families to make that choice. And then, as we know, as our budgets tighten, as we are here today, that concentrating spending on areas and individuals most in need will become more critical. And I think that's where we find ourselves today. And I just want to thank you, Mr. Baker, for taking time out of all the good things that Ecolab does, though, to invest in our youngest learners. So thank you so much.
Madam Chair, just a quick question for
Chair,
Mr. Baker.
Chair Dabney.
Good to see you again, sir. Thank you for coming before the conference committee. When the Early Learning Scholarship Program was created, and even the work before that that you referenced, there were a couple of pillars, and choice and flexibility were one or two of those pillars, depending on how you think about it. Another one of the pillars was quality, and that this wasn't simply supposed to be, here's a check, mom or dad, go find anywhere. It was to use this as a point of leverage to increase the quality of early care in Minnesota. And so we limited scholarships to only 3- and 4-star parent aware rated programs. Is quality still a priority? Is that still a pillar to the program in your mind?
Mr. Baker.
I believe so, absolutely. I think quality is critical in terms of getting the results that we tested for, and so that you want to make sure that you are driving quality programs, and these scholarships being tied to quality, I think, is also important.
Thank you, sir.
Madam Chair?
Yes, I thought Chair Pinto might have something to say. Chair Pinto is the chair of the Early Learning Committee in the House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I should note that the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division are really trying to take a comprehensive approach on both the health and human services side and education as well. And I really just want to thank Mr. Baker for his work and leadership through the years. We've had a little bit of chance to talk, and I know we may land in some different places as far as where we should be dedicating investment in the youngest years, but the need to invest in the youngest years, and that is where the biggest payoff is for our society, I know that we share that view, and so I want to thank you for that and look forward to ongoing conversations. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Mr. Baker, thank you for your ongoing leadership in this important area. Members, we do have a couple brochures that are coming around that will give you some further information, but it sounds like everyone's pretty well-versed on the importance of our early learning scholarships. Next, back to Zeke. Zeke, thank you so much for your patience, and welcome to the committee. Zeke, if you could kindly introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about People for PSEO and the provisions important to you, as well as the gentle lady beside you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and the members of this committee. My name is Zeke Jackson. I'm the Executive Director of People for PSEO, and I've been a student at the University of Minnesota for the past 2 years,
Welcome. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Asiya Brown, and I'm a full-time PSEO student as well at the University of Minnesota and a junior in high school currently.
Thank you. And repeat your name for us again, please.
Asiya Brown.
Asiya, thank you. Welcome.
People for PSEO is a nonprofit organization that is committed to promoting, defending, and expanding the PSEO program through various informational and advocacy functions. I want to thank each of you for your hard work this legislative session and for the bipartisan support of the PSEO program. We also appreciate the House and Senate support for the two other provisions of People for PSEO that the People for PSEO has suggested, neither of which will cost taxpayers a single cent. But today I'm here to speak specifically about the transportation provisions, which would allow increased access for students of low income to participate in the PSEO program. Before talking about the transportation provisions, I want to briefly discuss the role of PSEO in decreasing one of the state's largest graduation gaps between students of different races. Research that we shared in the previous House and Senate hearings showed that low-income students who participate in PSEO are 19 percentage points more likely to graduate from high school. That's in an MDE, Minnesota Department of Education, chart that you should have in front of you. And also on that chart shows that students of color who participate in PSEO are 30 percentage points more likely to graduate from high school. Many scholars have pointed out that for the first-generation college students, taking courses on a high school campus or from a college faculty member produces what researchers call academic momentum. It gives them critical self-confidence, and it shows them what they need to do to be a successful college student. In another paper in front of you, published by a Texas organization, it says that dual credit participation has dramatically increased not just high school graduation. One study found that students who are earning college credit in high school were nearly 50% more likely to earn a college degree from a Texas college within 6 years than students who had not participated in dual enrollment at all. So these studies are just one example of why the legislature should encourage participation in PSEO. But now I'd like to get back to the transportation issue and its context in the PSEO program. I'm also excited to show you guys a new piece of research that just came out this week that no one else has seen quite yet. So in 1985, the PSEO program was created under Governor Rudy Perpich. And one of the big discussions of that time was centered around the idea of school choice. And as such, the PSEO program was actually initially intended to serve as to serve academically gifted students who wanted to experience more than what their high school had to offer. However, over the course of the past 34 years, this has changed due to various factors, such as the rapidly inflating costs of a college education. Now, in 1985, when the PSEO program was created under Governor Rudy Perpich, it was also recognized that transportation to PSEO classes would be a huge barrier to participation for low-income students. As such, they created a transportation reimbursement fund. It sat at a rate of 15 cents per mile, and today that transportation reimbursement rate still sits at 15 cents per mile. And a recent study confirms that it is a problem. According to a PSEO capstone project that was published just this week by a team of Humphrey students, transportation remains a barrier for many PSEO students. They found an increasing need for the modernization of this funding as well, with the number of PSEO students that qualify for free or reduced price lunch accounting for a total of 22.8% of total participants in 2016. That can be found on the page in front of you that contains a small graph. If this legislature is interested in ensuring that the students who participate in PSEO are an accurate reflection of the diversity that is present in the state, a change to our transportation reimbursement rates are absolutely necessary. Just as Doug Barr, who just spoke before me, said, if you put low-income students in a high-quality setting, it really makes an impact. Thank you for your time, and I hope that you have some questions that I'm able to answer.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to also mention that as someone who has gone through and is currently a PSEO student, it's really a great opportunity, especially versus the high school that I would have gone to. It's like a really great opportunity to be able to do PSEO, and it's really important. But transportation is a big issue with it, and if this reimbursement were increased, it would be really helpful for people like me and me.
Thank you. Thank you. And so thank you for the information before us. We also noted we passed out a book from a page from the governor's budget talking about PSEO, the purpose and context, and that it does support our world's best workforce goal of reducing racial and economic achievement gaps for low-income students by reimbursing their transportation costs. The Senate bill in front of you increases how many students would be eligible for this PSEO transportation, and currently it's at a very low number. In fact, there's only not even 100 students who qualify, but the Senate bill increases that to students who qualify for free and reduced lunch so that more of our students will have the ability to get to post-secondary setting where they can earn those PSEO credits. And I'm guessing all of the members on both, I know the Senate, we've talked specifically about this, and I'm guessing perhaps in the House too, the increased graduation rates both from high school and college, and of course the lower student debt and the higher GPAs, all things that are incredibly important. But particularly when we look at kids from different racial backgrounds, we see increased graduation rates by double digits if they've taken PSEO courses or CTE courses. So thank you so much. Members, any comments or questions for our PSEO students? Well, thank you very much, and we appreciate you being here today, and thanks for the good information, and continue on.
Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you. Members, next we have a bit of discussion on the, let me look at my agenda here, on the construction and skilled trades counseling and report. I know there was some brief discussion on that earlier, and we have the commissioner from the Department of Labor and Industry here today who could give us a little bit of information on that. Commissioner? Do I see Commissioner Lepnick? Well, maybe not yet. Perhaps we're ahead of schedule, and we'll have the commissioner come when she gets here. Then we next on our agenda we have Daniel Sellers with Ed Allies. Do I see Daniel? Welcome. Speaking about the alternative teacher prep grant, and welcome to the committee, Daniel. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam and Mr. Chair and members. My name is Daniel Sellers. I serve as Executive Director of EdAllies. During the 2011 legislative session, the legislature authorized the development of alternative teacher preparation programs with the explicit intent to expand pathways to teacher licensure in Minnesota, improve racial and cultural diversity in our teacher workforce, and close student achievement gaps. In 2017, the legislation provided $750,000 in grant funding for alternative pathway providers to seek unit approval and develop teacher prep programs. That alternative teacher preparation grant program that goes by the acronym ATPGP was administered through the Office of Higher Education. I have more acronyms forthcoming. And has thus far been very successful. SF 1270, which was included in the Senate Education Omnibus Bill, would renew this one-time appropriation. I want to note that SF 1270 and its companion, HF 1233, received bipartisan sponsorship and co-sponsorship in both chambers. In the Senate, the bill had a Republican chief sponsor with both Republican and DFL co-authors. In the House, HF 1233, which did not receive a hearing, had a DFL chief sponsor with both DFL and Republican co-authors. So last summer in 2018, seven organizations applied for funding through the competitive grant program, and five programs received grants. I want to share just a few highlights from several of these programs. First, in summer of 2018, the Lakes Country Service Cooperative in Fergus Falls was awarded a $150,000 grant to build career and technical education CTE licensure programs for incumbent teachers to attain additional CTE licenses or endorsements. Lakes Country Service Cooperative became the first Minnesota program ever approved as an alternative preparation provider, and they're currently training their first cohort of CTE teachers. Lakes Country Service Cooperative strives to create an efficient, affordable, competency-based program that is a clear pathway to obtain licensure and nimble enough to provide individualized areas of study. Second, Learning Disabilities Association of Minnesota, which does go by LDA, also received a grant and will train academic and behavior strategists, special education teachers, recognized as a shortage area by the Minnesota Department of Education. LDA has utilized the grant funding to develop and submit their licensure program to PELSBY. LDA received conditional provider approval and their program review from PELSBY, and their program review is currently taking place. LDA expects to welcome their first cohort of 20 teacher candidates in September. Candidate recruitment is looking strong. Over 40 potential candidates from 12 districts have applied. Third, thanks to the grant program, TNTP, a national education nonprofit, is working to create a new path into the classroom for talented paraprofessionals who are already working with Minnesota students every day. TNTP is in the process of seeking unit approval through PELSBY and will spend the next year seeking program approval and recruiting candidates to begin their program in the fall of 2020. Their Minnesota program is based on a model they've developed and refined over more than 20 years, and their model produces consistently positive results. Nearly 50% of TNTP teacher candidates identify as people of color, compared to less than 10% in traditional Minnesota prep programs. And research shows that TNTP-trained teachers are as effective as teachers who received traditional teacher training. A one-time renewal of this appropriation will help these and other programs build on their early successes and grow towards sustainability, ultimately closing teacher shortages and increasing teacher diversity in Minnesota. To share a bit more about one other ATPGP grant recipient, I'll turn it over to Makisha from Teach for America, and I welcome any questions at the conclusion of her testimony.
Makisha, welcome. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Makisha Nation, and I'm the Executive Director for Teach for America. We work in partnership with communities to expand educational opportunities to children that are facing poverty. It was founded in 1990, and Teach for America recruits and develops diverse and talented outstanding college students, as well as professionals that want to make an initial two-year commitment to teaching, and then also who go on to become lifelong leaders in education advocacy and promoting student opportunities. We've been operating in the Twin Cities here since 2009, and our cohort of first and second year teachers, about 35% are teachers of color. Two-thirds of our cohort come from low-income backgrounds, and this is really significantly different compared to the 4% teachers of color that are currently in the state of Minnesota. Additionally, we are really doing a good job of working with our school partners to make sure we're matching key shortage areas for our schools. So of my teachers that teach in the K-12 environment, 38% are teaching in high-need STEM subject matter areas. Our teachers have a strong impact on student learning, academic growth, and student agency, and we work closely with four partner schools to impact 2,300 students annually. There are about 750 Teach for America alumni in the Twin Cities, 475 of whom are working in education, including 17 principals. I'm really here today to support the renewal of the Alternative Teacher Preparation Grant for three key reasons. First, I think it's critical that our state support many different and rigorous pathways into the classroom, including alternative preparation, conventional, non-conventional programs. This will broaden the access to the profession and increase teacher diversity, as well as help to improve student outcomes. Second, OAT ran a very competitive grant process, and it was done admirably in terms of how they're administering the program. We actually have five programs that are working together, sharing best practices when it comes to program development for their unit approval, when it comes to strategies around recruitment. We've really seen a benefit from the way we're able to partner and share best practices. It's also causing a conversation with our traditional providers to say, what can we do about the way we approach standards? How can we look at outcomes together? It's really creating a momentum around what we can do to create innovative opportunities around teacher preparation holistically. Third, we know that Minnesota right now has one of the highest costs to licensure. When I talk to my colleagues that work across the country, we're the third highest when it comes to other states. And I think it's really important for us to encourage the investment that it takes for organizations to go through the process to be approved as a provider. I think it's going to give an opportunity to folks to enter the teaching pathway with less cost, with rigorous programming, of course, and we know that that's going to make a difference. All of our grantees have had the opportunity to work very closely with Pelsby, and I think that has been instrumental in both our own learning and how Pelsby has learned about some of the way we're looking at some of the provisions around unit provider and program approval. This work is really important, and we're just at the point now where we have one program fully approved and several along the way. I think this gives us a great opportunity to not only think about our school's needs here in the Twin Cities, but across the state, if we actually have more affordable pathways into the classroom. And I'd love to see us continue the funding so that this great work can continue.
Thank you, Ms. Nation. Any comments or questions, members? Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sellers, good to see you again. As you know, the House provision, the House bill includes a significant historic investment in programs for teachers of color, or candidates of color to become teachers. Hearing you speak, the Lake Country Co-op, what percentage of their teachers, candidates? I'm not sure quite what the language is. Yeah. Candidates?
Yeah.
What percentage of their candidates are of color?
I don't have that information, but I can. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. I can get it to you. And I know their focus is on preparing CTE teachers for shortage areas, mm-hmm. but it was a requirement and continues to be a requirement to receive the grant funding to focus on recruiting educators of color. So I can track that down. Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you.
Mr. Sellers, the LDA program?
Yes.
What percentage of their candidates are
teachers? So they're going through the recruitment process right now. They're in the middle of recruiting candidates. So they've received 40 applicants. I don't know the percent currently of those teachers.
Madam Chair. And Mr. Sellers, the TNTP program, that 50% is fabulous. I've been a supporter of the Q programs so that we have intentional programs, because I think we're only going to make progress if we're intentional about it. 50% of their Minnesota candidates are of color? That's remarkable.
Mr. Sellers?
Madam Chair, Chair Dabney. So the TNTP numbers are their national numbers. So they've been operating for 20 years. And their national numbers are now 50% educators of color. They are, as Ms. Nation spoke, they are going through the process of unit approval right now. So all of these programs actually have to achieve the same exact standards as any conventional or traditional preparation program. And that has proven, and we think rightfully so, because Minnesota has high standards, to be a long and arduous and time-consuming process, because they apply to Pelsby and have to demonstrate they meet the exact same standards as any teacher prep program. So TNTP is in the process of going through that. They've received conditional approval to be a provider in the state, and they're going through the program approval, which is the individual subject area matters. They will not actually place teachers until the fall of 2020. So they're in the process of recruiting, of planning for the recruiting phase. But if history is any indication, there's no doubt that they will recruit an incredibly diverse cohort.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further comments or questions? Thank you for the concise report. Thank you, Ms. Nation. In our remaining few minutes, I'm still looking for the commissioner. Do we have anyone from the Department of Labor and Industry here? No. So we'll come back to that at a later time. Next, we have one of the other brief items of discussion we had to do with our literacy initiatives in the Senate bill. And so I have John Alexander from Groves Academy. If you could come and speak a little bit about literacy preparation, literacy teaching, and about what you have experienced and seen at Groves Academy. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, I'm John Alexander, and I'm currently on sabbatical from Groves Academy, so I'm really a literacy consultant today, consulting with various organizations around how we can improve literacy instruction, particularly for struggling and emerging readers, so that would be the K-3 space. To maybe put my comments in context, about 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, a colleague, Susan Thompson, who's sitting over here, and I testified in front of, I can't remember if it was the Senate or House Education Committee regarding literacy matters. Based on that testimony, we were asked to serve on the Literacy or Reading Task Force for the state of Minnesota. And that was conducted by the Board of Teaching. We were told that it was a one-year commitment, and it ended up being a three-year commitment. We were principal authors of the standards that are now in place for teachers coming out of colleges of education. One of, I think, our biggest failings of that effort was that it was only directed towards teachers in colleges of education. So any teacher who held a teaching license was grandfathered and didn't have to have the same exposure to the standards that new teachers would have. So you can imagine a 22 or 23, 24-year-old coming out of a college of education, going into a large public school district with knowledge standards that had to be met through an assessment to show that they had understanding of these standards, moving into a school within a large district, very hard for them to affect change in the way literacy was being taught in the early grades. So, therefore, our needle hasn't really moved in terms of literacy scores, reading scores on the MCA and other state measures. This bill, as I understand it, and I have to give apologies in that I was contacted about 11:30 this morning about this testimony this afternoon, so I'm not as well prepared as I might be if I had a couple of days. You might be better served listening to teachers who have come through training programs like those described in the bill, the Senate bill, I believe. I'm very familiar with these programs. In fact, the standards that I was a principal author of back in 2006 through 2009, those standards are largely from these organizations. The beliefs that they expound and that they train their teachers in. And I think most, and this is my 34th year working with both students and teachers in reading instruction. And probably more powerful, much more powerful than my testimony would be teachers who have come through these training programs who fill out surveys after the fact. And invariably we see in the surveys, why wasn't this information given to us in earlier in our college experiences? It wasn't until after college that these training programs provided this to us. That's changing now that we have these new standards in place for almost 10 years. But that still leaves a large percentage of teachers out there who have not been in schools of education within the last 10 years in Minnesota who don't have the same knowledge standards as perhaps these newer teachers do. And it puts a premium then on professional development of teachers always, always. We know in literacy, the tenets of good literacy instruction, that there's no longer a reading war around those tenets. It's how much time we spend teaching certain elements of those tenets, when we do it, and having teachers understand the stages of reading development that students go through in acquiring to become proficient readers and spellers and writers. That's what this training allows teachers in the workforce now to get. And as I understand it, and again, I apologize for not understanding the bill as well as I might, this is not mandatory. So this is allows teachers another pathway to get information that's so sorely needed that's not mandated, but they'd be reimbursed for it. Many of the teachers who have been through training programs that I've been associated with are paying out of their own pocket. And we can argue the compensation of teachers and whether that's appropriate or not in our society, but certainly having teachers reimbursed for science, evidence-based professional development makes all the sense in the world. And I'll give you an example right now, whether you're a teacher or not. This is what we're training teachers towards. Adults conceptualize the words in their visual or in their printed form. Young, emerging, and struggling readers do not. And let me give you an example. If I had an overhead to show you, I'd put the word and conceptualize this in your mind, the word GRS. And then I ask teachers and parents who come to my free workshops, what is that child trying to spell? And I know what he's trying to spell, both because I have a literacy background and it was in the context of the sentence. So I cheated a little bit because I had the context of the sentence. What do you think GRS, that second grade child, was trying to spell?
Grass.
Good guess. Greece, girls, are all responses that I get. So I told you just a minute ago that adults conceptualize words in their printed form. Students, emerging readers, and struggling readers conceptualize words in their spoken form. So this student was actually trying to spell the word dress. So I want everybody to look funny and sound funny. Say the word dot.
Dot.
Say the word drip. I would take you past your 4:45 time if anybody wants to debate with me whether the D in dot and the D in drip are pronounced the same way. The R affects the pronunciation of the D, making it sound like a J. And every single DR word, every single DR syllable will follow that pattern. Teachers need to understand that so that they can correct a student when they make that error. Teachers don't understand that, and this is the type of training that will be provided to them so that they can teach in a diagnostic, prescriptive way. Diagnostic, recognize an error. Where does the error come from? Errors that kids make are not random, by and large. They come from somewhere. Understanding where that error comes from, and equally important, how do you correct it? So diagnostic, prescriptive teaching is a tenet, an underlying part of the framework of each of these three programs. And I don't know how in good conscience that we're not mandating it. Why wouldn't we reimburse teachers to get this type of knowledge? And that's all I have.
Oh, thank you. Chair Yuki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't catch your name. I did hear.
Yeah, my name is John Alexander.
Alexander. Thank you, Mr. Alexander. Groves Academy is in my district. It's a wonderful, wonderful school, and I need to take another tour. But you did mention you were on sabbatical there, and you said you were a literacy consultant. Who do you work for?
I am in discussions with Reading Corps, Minnesota Reading Corps, and with individual schools as well as teachers, not just in Minnesota but across the country.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I did listen to part of the hearing in the Senate, and I just wanted to make sure, are you specifically saying only the three programs listed here can give that training?
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying those three programs do have the tenets of the standards that were created back in 2009 and signed off by the Board of Teaching, and an assessment signed off by then-Governor Pawlenty. No, I can't comment on other programs because I just don't have the intimate knowledge of those programs. But I know the three listed do hold to those tenets.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sure, you can.
Anymore. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Alexander, are those three programs for profit or private?
I believe they're all nonprofit.
That's not the information I have. I think they're all for profit, but
Wilson may be for profit, but I think Orton Gillingham is Academy is nonprofit. I'm sure that IMSLEC is as well.
Thank you. And with your expertise, one more question. I know it's really important to me, with your expertise around dyslexia and reading intervention, do you see a difference between something being scientifically based or evidence-based?
Yeah, I would prefer that we look at evidence-based programs that get results. There's a lot of bad science out there, too.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Groves. We'll get the information on the providers.
I'd just like to make a note there that I'm not affiliated with any of those providers in any way.
Thank you. Lastly, I believe we have the commissioner. Mm-hmm. Commissioner, welcome to the Education Committee. Please introduce yourself for the record. And Commissioner?
Yes, I'm Nancy Lepink, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. And we wanted to talk just a little bit about the Construction and Skilled Trades Counseling and Report. If you could give us a little bit of information about that, please.
Sure. So the Department, of course, supports Article 2, Section 4 of the bill, which would require the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to collaborate with the Commissioner of Education, which I think is very important, to incorporate construction and skilled trades into career counseling services for middle and high school age students. And the department is ready, willing, and able to engage in that partnership with the Department of Education. We see a growing interest in all sorts of opportunities for students to become more knowledgeable about what are the career opportunities in the trades, growth in interest in things like apprenticeship programs, in particular, registered apprenticeship programs in the trades. So consequently, the opportunity and to be more forthright in letting students know, but actually what we're finding is also letting their parents know, who often have very specific opinions about their children working in the trades. So this is an opportunity through the schools to get that information out to both students and their parents. We also support the idea that we would look to find a way to have that training be hands-on training for students, but of course want to ensure that the safety and health of those students is a paramount priority in any kind of training program that we would look at developing.
Thank you, Commissioner. We brought this forth because we know we just have such a workforce crisis. Right. I know there's great jobs that are available to our students, and we don't have that hands-on training as much as we would like to see, and we want to know what those opportunities are, but of course want to make sure that student safety is paramount. Right. So this was a provision in the Senate bill. So any comments or questions?
Madam Chair?
Chair Daffney.
Thank you much. Commissioner Lepping, good to see you. This may not be a fair question, but I'm wondering if you could briefly familiarize the committee with the youth skills training program under your department. There's a much more limited proposal in one of the bills. And I'm familiar as the chief author, I guess, of the youth skills training program proposal this year, but if you could familiarize the committee to the best of your ability on. Sure. Please.
So, go ahead. So the chair, representative. So the youth skills training program is a program that primarily focused on high demand industries like manufacturing, technology, home health care, and also agriculture, where there's a demand for workers and wanting to and where the department assists in developing partnerships between educational institutions like high schools and community colleges and vocational education institutions, and also then with employers who are interested in combining an opportunity to experience what kinds of careers may be available to them in these sectors through an experiential program where they spend a certain number of hours during the day in a manufacturing facility or in a home health care facility, but that is also combined with education, educational opportunities often related to safety and health or other education that's related to that career. And so what we're finding is that, you know, for many students, they really don't have any idea about what are the opportunities, say, in manufacturing, and that they have very old ideas along with their parents about what a manufacturing job looks like today. And so consequently, this is a way, and furthermore, to understand what the full scope of careers are in that sector. So it's not necessarily just working on a shop floor, but it's also the opportunity for design and for logistics and for sales, a full aspect of all of what these careers are about. And what we're finding is that not only are students finding this a really excellent experience, and really for many of them, a place where when they really didn't think a four-year college was what they wanted to do, that this program is sort of affirming for them that there's other ways that you can earn a living and contribute to society than necessarily pursuing what would be you would acquire in a four-year college degree. And we're also finding that the manufacturers are also learning a lot from those students because they're seeing what is it that those students want to know about in terms of their sector. And also they're thinking more about how do they actually create a career, not just fill a spot, you know, a vacant position, but how do they actually create a career for new workers in the context of their industry. So I think it's been a really positive collaboration with community development organizations, business organizations, schools, and businesses to create these opportunities. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for this program, and many people, we have actually more demand than we can currently meet. So, and of course, that experience would clearly feed into how do we go about creating positive and educational and safe experiences in elsewhere.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Seeing no other questions, thank you so much. And members, I just want to thank you for your patience today. We had a number of testifiers. We went rather quickly. We handed out some documents. I'm going to give you just one more. Again, just wanted to give you a flavor of some of the things that are in the Senate bill and an opportunity to hear some of the testimony that we did have in the Senate Education Committee. So again, thank you. The last document that I'm just handing you has to do a little follow-up. I think we talked about the Minnesota Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum when we talked about the curriculum best practices. This gives you a little idea of what's in place now and what school districts subscribe to this like digital online learning catalog of open resources, open educational resources that have been are tied to Minnesota standards, and we'd just like to take that further so all of our kids have opportunities for that. So, with that, members, I just thank you for your time, and
this meeting is adjourned, but before we do, we need to hear from the chair about what the next one is.
Yeah. You get to hold on to the gavel right, for another 2 or 3 minutes. Yep. Madam Chair, we intend the House is convening at 9 tomorrow. We'll meet at 10 tomorrow. We'll recess, come back, and get some work done. But we would intend to convene the conference committee at 11:30. I'm wondering, Madam Chair, in the effort to keep the work moving,
yes.
I would like to propose that we assemble two work groups. You raised PSEO today. It was great having Zach in front of the committee. Both bills have provisions on PSEO. They're not exact. They're not identical. But we could put together a working group to look at the PSEO provisions. Both also have provisions related to the BIE schools. And again, there's some similarities. There's, I believe, maybe even some sames, but there's also some differences. So I'd like to propose that we assemble two work groups, recruit our members to dig in on some meat, and see if we can't make some progress there.
I'll have to get back with you as I talk to the rest of our team here. As you can tell, the Senate is spread pretty thin. This is the first time I think we've had all of our senators in seats at the same time here. I should take a picture. We're still missing Senator Weber. Yep. We just don't have quite as many members, but we have just as many conference committees to cover, so it makes it just a little bit harder for us. Was your idea to have the working groups work off on their own sometime while we're not in conference committee and then bring the results back, or what were your intentions? What would you like to see with the working groups that can help as I talk to the rest of the Senate?
Sure, Madam Chair, that was the intent, allow them to work independently, see if they can reach some agreement. Both of these areas, I think, are places where we could relatively easily get to some agreement and have that sitting for when the Senate is ready to get to work on negotiating the whole bill.
Actually, as soon as we get our targets, so let's hope there's a miracle in that fishing boat on Saturday. And once we get those targets, we do want to be able to really move forward quickly.
Madam Chair, yes. I know that the revisor's office is getting more concerned. I don't know if Ms. Guinness is here. She's our revisor. I don't know if you've connected with her this session.
Only in appreciation. It's amazing to me what has been accomplished already in such a short amount of time, being able to assemble our side-by-sides.
And she's new. This is her first session.
Yes, it is. Well done. Stand up. Thank you so much.
Oh, there you go. Madam Chair, she used to be an attorney for the U.S. State Department, which I assume means she knows stuff she can't tell us. But I think the revisor's office is starting to message to our leadership that if we want to get done on time, which I know is the House's goal, we need to be respectful of revisor's staff, Ms. McGinnis, and the full staff there in their capacity simply to process what we decide into a final product so that we can move it before the 20th, before our constitutional adjournment date.
Thank you. We have talked about that, and our feeling was maybe a little bit of calm before the storm here. In other words, until we get those budget targets and we're ready to roll those out, we know that you might need to take a couple deep breaths now, because once we get those budget targets, things are going to be moving pretty quickly. And we know there won't be any weekend times that are not filled. We know all of our times will be filled with assembling these bills. So I just want to congratulate you. Thank you. And know that enjoy today, because we know shortly things are going to get much more hectic. But we appreciate the great job. With that, and also just to give the committee members a little bit of insight. Chair Daphne is going to have the gavel on Friday. I understand we'll be in at 11:30. And then do you have any idea how long we might be in on Friday?
3-4 hours, maybe.
Okay. Perhaps 3 to 4 hours on Friday, members. And on Saturday, we'll come in at 2. So we'll have
And then on, we do not plan to meet on Sunday, but we will most likely, obviously, we'll be ready on Monday. So with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.